golden retriever, about to be 7 years old, Shadow the Golden, has 6,000 followers on Twitter. So he's more of a superstar than any of us are at this point.
Yeah, no doubt about that. Well, and we'll get to an article you wrote about Ralph Kruger and coaching in a minute, and I thought it was a really good read. Now, before we get to that, last night, the Boston Bruins punched their ticket to the Stanley Cup Final yet again. It's the third time with, obviously, the same cast of characters as Zdeno Chara, who didn't play last game, but Patrice Bergeron and, of course, Brad Marchand. How do the Bruins have this success again? They rebuilt their team on two different occasions, and they find themselves back in a Cup Final.
You know what? It's the fact that they've been able to cycle through generations of star players. The fact that they still have the Bergeron, Marchand, and Zdeno Chara-level guys, David Krejci from 2011, and that they've been able to bring in a David Pastrnak, a Charlie McAvoy, even Tuukka Rask, who was the backup that year and has a Stanley Cup ring, went to the final in 2013, and then you acquire a Charlie Coyle. You develop all of these players to where you can let Zdeno Chara not play 25 minutes a night. You don't have to count on just that top line to produce all the time. And I think between Don Sweeney and before that, Peter Chiarelli had done a really good job of developing. And we always talk about this with the Canucks, is that if the Sedins, as they get older, if you replace with the next generation, they can be second and third line players. And I think the Bruins have done a really good job since 2011 of keeping that farm system, the drafts and develop, and a few smart trades in there, that they've been able to stay on top because they've been able to push some of those older players to where they don't have to have as big a role.
No, you're right about that. And especially with Krejci, Patrice Bergeron still remains one of the best two-way forwards in the NHL. And then what else can you say about a guy like Brad Marchand, who isn't everybody's favorite, obviously, for reasons we don't need to get into. But the level of play he's able to get to in the playoffs really does put him in that Conn Smythe conversation if they do end up winning the Cup.
It does, and I think Tuukka Rask probably is the favorite right now, just given how he's played, especially in these elimination games for other teams, to be able to close out other teams. But Brad Marchand, for all the talk of the licking and for his antics post-game that I'm not a huge fan of, honestly, he's been playing great. I mean, this is the Brad Marchand who earned that contract a couple years ago from the Bruins, the long-term big money deal. He's as much of a pest as he can be. He's incredibly skilled, and he not only can he be able to set guys up. He's got a great finish, and when you play with the Bergerons, you play with the Krejcis, you play with the Pasternaks, to have so many threats on the ice at the same time to be able to score, it's a nightmare for opposing defenses to have to try to deal with. How do we stop Bergeron? How do we stop Marchand? You can't stop all of these guys at the same time, and that's what's made the Bruins so dangerous and has gotten them into the Cup Final.
Don Sweeney or Bruce Cassidy, who do you think of these two deserve more of the credit for this run here, or maybe they mutually share that sort of mantle together?
I think it's 50-50, and a lot of times you try to figure out who deserves credit for success when you're kind of figuring out awards and that sort of stuff, and Don Sweeney is in as a finalist now for GM of the Year. But Bruce Cassidy, for me, is such a fantastic story in that he reinvented himself. He was a horrible coach for the Capitals in the early 2000s. It was his team, the team that he coached, that was so bad that the Capitals won the draft lottery to get Alex Ovechkin and basically made this entire era of Washington Capitals hockey. And he goes to the minors. He gets better. He learned from that experience so much that I think I compare it to Bill Belichick a little bit, and that like a lot of NHL coaches like Belichick from his first job where it was unsuccessful to now being the greatest NFL coach of all time. Bruce Cassidy is better in his second job, and Mike Sullivan certainly better, wins the Stanley Cup in his second job. Joel Quenneville won it in his third job. Bruce Cassidy is the kind of guy who he really has become a better coach over that time, and it's allowed the Bruins to have success because he's pushed all the right buttons.
Talking with Stephen Wino of the Associated Press here on Sportsnet 650. And on the other side of the bracket, we know the Bruins are waiting to see who's going to emerge out of the Western Conference. So who do you think between St. Louis and San Jose actually has the best chance to beat the Boston Bruins?
I think it's San Jose. And look, the Sharks have been, and Peter DeBoer is going to get mad at even suggesting this, they've gotten fortunate on a few occasions on being the beneficiaries of some incorrect or some missed calls. And not to say they don't deserve to be in this spot, because they do. They've taken advantage of these situations each and every time. But this the Sharks have this feel of a team of destiny, and not just because of that, but look at the talent they have and the depth they have, to where if you try to shut down Logan Couture, which no one's been able to do, Timo Meier can beat you, or Joe Pavelski can beat you, or George Thornton has a big game. On the blue line, if Eric Cross is not scoring, Brent Burns is, or you've got a Brendan Dillon. This is or Mark-Edward Vlasic even came up with a big goal earlier in the playoffs. This is a really deep team that, as long as Martin Jones doesn't have to be spectacular, if Martin Jones is his regular self, I think the Sharks can beat the Bruins.
And before we kind of get to the rest of that series with the Blues and the Sharks, what about the Carolina Hurricanes? They obviously had a overachieving season to some extent. But they have a lot of players who contracts are up, managers who have contracts that are up, and same with some coaches. Where do you think the Carolina Hurricanes, which direction do they go this offseason?
I think it's a lot of status quo with some tweaks on the margins. Don Waddell has shown, also similar to Don Sweeney, or similar to the Cassidy thing about coach, Don Waddell in his second job as GM has done a good job. The Peter Mrazek and signing and the Curtis McElhinney waiver claim turned out very well. Rod Brind'Amour is certainly a motivational coach who guys will skate through a wall for, and it's worked. I think you need to bring back Mrazek and McElhinney. I think that combination stays. I'll be curious to see what happens with Justin Williams and his future in with the Hurricanes and in hockey. I think even as he's getting older, he sets the tone for that team and all the storm surge and all that. But this is a team that a lot of their young players are just going to get better. You're going to get a better season out of Svechnikov. You're going to see some of these guys who were called up for one or two games in the playoffs become full-time NHL players. And I think they're going to be an even better team now that they've gotten a little taste of a deep playoff run.
The biggest one for me is Sebastian Aho. What do you do with a player like him? Are they willing, you believe, to give him that $9 to $10 million per season, or would they rather bring it down a bit lower? And can you negotiate a more favorable deal with a player like Sebastian Aho?
I think if owner Tom Dundon is willing to open up the pocketbook and spend a little bit more money than this team has in the past, that you do. You commit to Sebastian Aho long term. I think he's a budding superstar in this mm-hmm. league. You have the option of a bridge deal. You have the option of a 2 or 3 year deal at $6 or $7 million to be able to do that. But if you've got a guy who in Tom Dundon, who is a billionaire, who, even though the American Alliance for football didn't work out, still has money to burn, for lack of a better term, that I think you do invest long term in Sebastian Aho, because you don't want to lose a talent like that. And in 3 or 4 years after a bridge deal is done, you might be paying even more than $9-10 million a year.
And I find it interesting that we don't see enough offer sheets. And when you start looking at the compensation for offer sheets for this season, I mean, you can give up a first round pick, a second and a third, and you know, you're in that $6 to $7 million range. And if you really want to push the envelope, give up 2 firsts, a second and a third in that $9 to $10 million range. Do we see any team maybe take advantage and try to think they can do an offer sheet for a player like Sebastian Aho with maybe Dundon not being willing to match? Or is that just a pipe dream we talk about in the media and fans?
It's a pipe dream. You always hear every year, and I hear the whispers too, of, oh, this guy wants to offer sheet this guy or this and that. You know what it feels like, honestly, in the current system, and it should be looked at in the next CBA? It feels like nuclear weapons. It feels like mutually assured destruction. Mm-hmm. That if a general manager goes and tries to offer sheet a player, that the next time he has a guy coming up, you better sign him before it gets to an offer sheet, because you're going to have guys lining up to do the same thing to you. I think there's this kind of threat on offer sheets, just the way the system works, that you're not going to see them. And same thing with an Aho, same thing with Mitch Marner in Toronto. I think these guys, they don't have rights because they're RFAs, and I don't think teams are going to use offer sheets on any of these players.
And I find that to be a bit of a shame. I mean, it's fully allowed, it's legal, it's not encouraged, but it'd be a very fun way for, of course, us in the media and for fan bases to look at more player movement in the offseason. But we'll see exactly when offer sheets become a thing yet again in the NHL. The St. Louis Blues, we know they are riding on the power of not just some solid goaltending this year, but maybe the power of a certain song. And you did some digging, Stephen, and you realized and discovered that wonderful, glorious song, it didn't actually originate from the city of St. Louis itself. So break it down for us, how the Blues came to be with this song here, and what's kind of, you know, budded into a wonderful relationship between these two.
This is one of the wackiest stories I've ever been a part of, and it started with the South Philadelphia Bar. That's a Mummers Club. A Mummers Parade is an annual New Year's Day parade where people dress up and march down the street, and there's this competition for awards, and this group of friends who've been together for 20, 30 years won first prize. Their song that they had played the entire time, their victory song, was Laura Branigan's Gloria. And a handful of players went into that bar to watch the Eagles-Bears playoff game in early January. They're playing the song every commercial break. The players are getting into it. Jordan Binnington has his first shutout the next night, and all of a sudden the players are like, we like this song. We're rolling. We're going to take this song. And all of a sudden it's become this St. Louis blues craze that started at a South Philadelphia bar in the middle of Flyers country and has now become this entire phenomenon.
I love that story. I just love everything about it. Just Blues having fun. And now here they are, still in the Western Conference Final. We know the last game, a bit of a controversial decision that led to the overtime winner, but they're still in it. They're still alive, at least for now. Who needs to step up the most in order for St. Louis to really make this a series and maybe win the whole thing?
Honestly, it probably has to be Jordan Binnington. And not even saying that it's been his fault, but he's had so many games during the stretch to get from last in the NHL to the playoffs and early on in this playoffs where he's allowing fewer than two goals a game. And then if he gets lit up, if he gets to three, four, five goals allowed, it's hard to match that firepower the Sharks have. And the Blues are a good team. Jaden Schwartz has been terrific. Ryan O'Reilly probably needs to be a little bit better. But this is a lot of this, again, the pressure's on Jordan Binnington now because he needs to be the Jordan Binnington who is a Calder Trophy finalist who got the Blues to this point. And he's going to need to potentially steal a game in this series. You're down 2-1 now going into game four tonight. And this is a situation where the Blues are going to have to, even if they're not saying that and saying everyone else has to be better, I think they're going to need an A-plus game in a lot of nights from now on from Jordan Binnington.
Well, and obviously the San Jose Sharks have had good fortune on their side throughout the postseason, and it has brought up the entire conversation about video review, officiating in the NHL. How do you view everything that's happened so far in the NHL playoffs? Is this just a matter of we're more in tune now, there are more cameras, there's more eyes on it, there's social media, so everything becomes a bigger deal? Or are we seeing a bit of a crisis when it comes to NHL officiating and maybe the review process having to be changed?
I think it's a crisis. I think it's that there are too many people I've talked to who are not in hockey in recent days who just say, how is it that four guys on the ice missed this and you're not able to fix it? And this is, for me, it's the Cody Eakin, Joe Pavelski situation in Game 7. It's the missed hand pass the other night. And the fact that you can review certain things but not other things, that there's not a common-sense approach to this right now. And we know in the NHL general managers, there's a glacial kind of pace to change and it always takes something like this for a change to be forced. But I wonder if an NFL-like policy that each goal gets reviewed by Toronto, not necessarily video by the officials on the ice, but just have the situation room in Toronto look at every video, look at the goal, at each goal scored, even if it's just in the playoffs at this point, and look at it, be able to call the arena and say, you guys missed this call, let's get it right. Because when you have the technology and you're not using it, everyone's saying, we want to get it right, but they're not even using the technology at their disposal to do that.
Yeah, and that's a big challenge, I believe. It's how do you perfect this system, but at the same time, not delay games too much. And I hear a lot of fans, Steven, say that they're losing interest in this playoffs because they feel like the officiating is a detriment to the game. To that point of it being a crisis, can that be enough, the backlash from fans, to usher in this change? Like you mentioned, like something like this has to happen for change to occur in the NHL.
I think so, and honestly, I don't think it's just the fans. I think the officials want this. Yeah. I think the officials would like the ability to either look at a video real quick to check themselves or have somebody be able to make that phone call to say, hey, guys, you missed this, because no one feels worse than the officials who miss a call. And the game is so fast, and these guys are so good. All you need to do is watch a World Championships where you have the next level down of officials to realize how good these refs and linesmen in the NHL really are, even as calls like this are being missed, but they're so good. Give them some help. Give them the ability to say, hey, we're going to take a look at this real quick, or a mechanism to where someone in Toronto can take a look at it and help them out. I know you don't want to delay the games. The league is very conscious of they don't want to make this kind of a slippery slope for replay and have games take 3 hours, but I think there's a way of doing this to help these guys out because they're the best in the world at this for a reason, and they still miss calls like this. And I think it's just, I think they need a little bit of assistance in these big moments so that you don't have the backlash of fans being turned off by officiating.
And is the concern of delaying the games really that big of a concern when you think about it? Because baseball games, especially baseball playoff games, they can go on for hours at a time. And we're still looking at the average length of a hockey game being around 2.5 hours, maybe 3 at most if you're thinking about shootout, overtime, and all the things in the regular season. So really, a couple of reviews that don't happen every game, it wouldn't go so far into delaying the game so much that people can't enjoy it still.
Yeah, but the league is really conscious of this, and the GMs are really conscious of this. Is they don't want to slow it down. They like that where they're at about 2 hours and 31 to 33 minutes average for a game. And then you look at baseball and you see how long some of these reviews take, and it's miserable. It does slow down the pace of the game. The question is, how much is too much replay in terms of how many situations do you want to make subject to review? Do you want a puck that's in the netting? Do you want a puck over the glass penalty? Like, what point is the dividing line for this? And that's where everyone's worried, because you did it for offside, and now there's this millimeter offside thing, and everyone's complaining about that. And there's all these unintended consequences. But they really are worried about slowing down the game and taking it too long. But the thing is, you really want to get calls right, and I think the line might have to be scoring plays only, and maybe major penalties. But then you start debating how much is too much, and that's where the GMs and the competition committee in June are going to have to get together and figure out a solution for this, because I don't think they can go into next season, next playoff, under the status quo.
Well, over in Buffalo, Ralph Kruger named the new head coach there after a few years with Southampton as one of their vice chairmen. So what are we expecting now out of the Buffalo Sabres with Ralph Kruger coming back behind the bench for the first time since that Oilers stint?
I think you're going to see a better team in time. Ralph Kruger, in talking to a lot of his colleagues in the last couple of days, is so good at building the culture of a team. He did it with the Swiss national team. He did it with Team Europe in the World Cup of Hockey, to where that process could take some time. I know for a short tournament like the World Cup of Hockey or an international tournament, it has to happen quicker. But I do think he's going to go in there and establish a culture, a standard for what it takes to be a team and to coalesce for a team that hasn't made the playoffs, longest drought in the NHL now, and certainly seems to have some cultural issues, seems to have some disconnects between the veterans and the young players. I think you're going to see a more accountable group. I don't know if it's going to happen right away, but the Sabres will be better because they will be more organized. Ralph Kruger is kind of a details person, but also a really good communicator and a people person and all that. And I think there's going to be a marked improvement in Buffalo that will maybe start seeing the results by the 2020-21 season, to where they'll legitimately be a contender.
He is Stephen Wino. Follow him on Twitter at SWino, AP hockey writer. And the article on Ralph Kruger is available on his Twitter feed. It's a good read. Time to check that out. Stephen, always a pleasure getting you on Sportsnet 650. We appreciate your time. Enjoy the rest of the playoffs. And we'll see how much change gets ushered in by the NHL when it comes to officiating.
Sounds good, guys. Talk to you soon.
Sportsnet 650.